KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Friday, February 21st, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Kanachi, Shawa, Toksuknus, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, we preview the Juno Piano Series, which has two concerts this weekend. The first happening this evening, featuring Edward Zubrakant, and the second this coming Sunday. We chat with John Doris from the Northwest Americans with Disabilities Act Center about the support it offers in Juneau and across Alaska. And cool jazz is on tap at the Crystal Saloon as Afelice Adaje continues their weekly Friday night residency. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That right there is the wonderful piano stylings of Edward Zubrakant. He is in town to play both a solo concert tonight and as part of Cynosure Trio this Sunday. Both concerts are at the Juno Arts and Culture Center and are part of the Juno Piano Series. For more information and tickets, you can visit jahc.org or call 907-586-2787. I'm joined now in studio by Edward and the director of the Juno Piano Series, John Hayes. Gunathchi, Shayadi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio this Friday afternoon. Wasaiti, how's it going?
Thank you very much. Good. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so what was that we were just listening to, Edward?
That was the middle part of The Great Gate of Kiev. It's the last movement of Mussorgsky's Pictures from an Exhibition. It's a monumental piano work of the Russian composer. And the last movement is The Great Gate of Kiev. There is no such thing as The Great Gate of Kiev, but it's based on a painting that Victor Hartmann did, and that's what Mussorgsky was representing.
And this is from the album that you did.
I did, yes.
Yeah. And as I was listening to it, I was imagining, do you remember recording the album? Like, do you remember playing the piano when you were recording this?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
What was that like?
Well, I mean, it's always very exciting to do a performance like this, and it was very special music. It was all Russian composers. I did works of Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, and Mussorgsky, and these were some of my favorite pieces and that I've always wanted to record. And so it's a very special feeling.
How much of a perfectionist are you? When you would play it, did you stop yourself and be like, nope, gotta go back to the beginning?
There's a there's a process of recording which is different than performance.
I mean,
one can be a perfectionist, but in performance, it's a live performance, and there's excitement to that. You want as much as possible in the recording to be the same thing, so there are ways to do it. You run the whole piece first, and then you maybe run it again, and then fix some things if need be. That's the process usually.
Yeah. When you listen back to it at all, is there ever any moment where you think, you know, because sometimes actors or other folks see a dance, you know, performance and they go, oh, I wish I could have done that twirl better. Or, oh, I should have done that. Is there sometimes when you hear it and you go, man, I wish I would have done that a little bit differently?
The performances evolve. In other words, one never plays exactly the same way. That's
right.
Why the good and bad of the recording, it's great to have it for posterity. This is how you played it. But it. Every performance is unique and different, so chances are people that will, if they know this particular recording and they know my playing, what they'll hear tonight is very different performance in
many
respects.
Okay.
So it's always very fresh and very exciting, and spontaneity is an important part of performance.
I always think about that with music because, you know, it's notes on a page, right? And you think, oh, everybody has to do that, but it's sort of like a script or
exactly.
a dance movement where it's like the words are there, but it's how you interpret it that would be different.
I've said before that the piano is sort of a perfect recording device, that it puts out exactly what you put into it, whether you intend to or not. So it really captures everyone's personality when they lay hands on it. So who you were when you made that recording, you're a different person now, despite virtue of time. So,
because I'm imagining, I know this is a little bit of a tangent from what we're talking about, but I just find it so fascinating because you could be tired one day and maybe you're not playing the keys with the same energy that you might have on the next night, right?
Everything changes every day. That's why we always say, you know, you play the phrase sometimes when it's winter, when it's summer, when it's dark, when it's light, when you're feeling happy, when you're sad, when you're sick, when you're healthy. All of those change the parameters, and how you approach a piece will change exactly.
And I guess as long as the piano's in tune, that's the first step, right?
It doesn't have to be. We don't get blamed for a piano being out of tune,
right.
For example, like strings do. The intonation is important for them.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about yourself. I know you are you've been in Fairbanks for over 20 years.
Since 97, I came as a professor of piano at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And for the last 25 years, I've been also the music director and conductor of the Fairbanks Symphony Orchestra.
Wow.
So sort of hold two positions and concertize in both. I guess conduct in Europe and in the United States as a guest conductor, and then I also perform as a soloist and chamber musician now, which I love doing very much. And I've performed with numerous artists, and one of my close friends and the local residents here, Paul Rosenthal and Linda Rosenthal, performed with them numerous times, and it's always been very exciting. And more recently with Zul Bailey, also probably a very featured person here in town that has done many things. So
absolutely.
I enjoy chamber music very much and enjoy playing that. And so, hold many hats at this point.
Yeah, and I know you've conducted, like you mentioned, sort of around the world. So Fairbanks is sort of home base.
It is.
Now, and you're originally from Russia.
I was born in Russia. Okay. My family immigrated when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
To the United States. We settled in Atlanta, Georgia, and then I was mentored by Robert Shaw and other conductors, then went to study at different universities, eventually studied in Germany, and then got positioned at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It's very exciting.
It's wonderful.
Small world.
Yeah.
And that's where John and I met.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And John, I know, does wonderful work with the piano series, bringing people from all over the state around and down into Juneau, and sometimes from outside as well, so that they can play. And we get to hear this wonderful stuff. And I just think it's awesome. What age did you start playing the piano?
Three? Yeah.
That's how it works sometimes, right?
And well, in Russia, like my father started me. He was a musician, so he started me very early. And by the time I was six, I was already in music school.
In music school at age six?
Yes.
So what's the first memory, or do you have a first memory of actually being able to read and understand the music, like when you got it?
I was 7 years old. I mean, that's when I wanted to do it on my own. I mean, before that, my father would always sit with me and guide me and do things. But I always had wonderful teachers and things. But at 7, I had my first performance on Russian television, and it was very exciting. And this is something I wanted. At the same time, I heard some great artists performing Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, and I said, that's the piece I want to play someday. And that sort of put me on a track that I've never left.
So it's so interesting to go on TV at age 7, and then you get that feeling, right? And it's like, oh, I like this.
at 7, it can be fun.
Yeah.
Now it could be a little bit nerve-wracking if you had to do
it. I love that. And I'm also curious just in terms of how folks see the world. Do you see the world in musical terms? Like, I guess what I'm saying is, like, when you're walking around in Fairbanks, let's say, and you're, you know, we do it here too. We don't have as much snow as you do in Fairbanks. But I'm just curious, like when you're crunching the snow with your boots or you hear the leaves of the wind rustle or things like that, does that become music for you?
My thoughts are always, I have so many things in the fire at the same time between orchestra rehearsals, this and that. We have a concert in a couple of weeks, this concert, two concerts this weekend. There's always something in my mind with music. I mean, I don't necessarily translate the sound of the snow or anything like that, but music is part of me, every part of me.
Every day. Wow, that's great. And I did want to understand a little bit the difference, because you conduct a lot, obviously, but you also play, as you mentioned.
Yes.
What is the main difference between that? When you're playing, do you do that thing where you're like, why is this conductor doing that? Because you want to be conducting, or are you able to sort of let that go and just be part of the performance?
I view conducting as the orchestra is an instrument to me, just like piano is an instrument. My goal in my mind is to recreate on the piano the colors that I hear in my head. And the beauty of an orchestra is that when you hear things like this with great masterworks from Beethoven, Mahler, or anything else, you can actually capture that with real life. And you can really, I mean, an orchestra becomes an instrument.
Mm.
And you can really be expressive and do everything. And I enjoy it very much. And that's, number one, to inspire other people to play on that high level. And, put things together is very, very exciting.
I love that. That's so cool.
And I would say doing the orchestra work informs piano playing, I'm sure, because piano is almost always a reference to some other type of music making. Mm. We say about Beethoven sonatas, like, is it a quartet or a symphony, or all these types of allusions that piano can take towards other types of ensembles.
Gotcha. Okay. So you're performing tonight. You're going to be over at the Jack right across the street here from KTOO. It starts at 7 p.m. this evening. What's on the program for tonight?
Two works. First is a middle period, one of the great piano sonatas by Beethoven, Opus 53 sonata in C major. It's called the Waldstein because it's dedicated to Count Waldstein. And then the second half, or not the second half, but the second piece on the program, there won't be an intermission, is the Mussorgsky's Pictures from an Exhibition, which is a monumental work. Most people know that piece from an orchestral version because Maurice Ravel orchestrated that piece. And that's how people really hear it many times. And some of them think, oh, this is an orchestral piece and you're doing a transcription. Whereas Mussorgsky's version is really very rustic and very Russian, and it's a very unique opportunity to hear this piece live in its original setting.
Okay. And then you're also part of the Cynosure Trio, which is happening on Sunday. Tell me a little bit about the other members of that trio and what we'll be hearing on Sunday.
Yes. We have violinist Yue Sun and cellist Charlie Akert. They're my colleagues. Yue is a professor of violin at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and concertmaster of the orchestra, and Charlie is associate concertmaster, a principal of the cello, and we decided to play together, and it's been very exciting, and we're playing again two big works, the famous Ghost Trio of Beethoven and a monumental Tchaikovsky piano trio, which is sort of almost a 50-minute work by itself for piano trio.
And I have a little bit of a sample of that. I'm going to go ahead and play that, a little bit of the Tchaikovsky, right?
Right.
So let's see
please.
If we can hear just a little bit of what this is that you'll be playing on Sunday. Just take a moment to listen to this. ¶¶ is Little Tchaikovsky, which we'll be playing with the Cynosure Trio on Sunday. And that performance, John, is in the afternoon.
Yes, 3 p.m.
3 p.m. on Sunday. And both of these performances are part of the Juno Piano Series, which you do in collaboration with a few people. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's really exciting. This is the sixth concert season the Juno Piano Series has had since 2018. The Juno Arts and Humanities Council is the umbrella. They deal with everything financial, and they take care of so many details for me, and that is a huge help. And then also this year we have a sponsor. AARP Alaska has generously sponsored the piano series, so that is very exciting, and I am super, super thankful for the support. It feels more real every year.
Yeah, you've been doing this for a few years now, like you said, 6 years, and it's just wonderful to be able to have this kind of music here in Juno and to sort of highlight that and to highlight the musicians from around the state, really from around the world who have maybe moved here, like Edward has. Edward, I wanted to ask you, too, the difference between putting together a program for your solo performance tonight versus working with the trio. Is there anything that you think about in terms of how you put those programs together?
No, I mean, we wanted to do, number one, you want variety, so it's not always all the same pieces. And when you're playing somewhere, you want to do something that is very popular and will really appeal to the audiences. I mean, sometimes it's good to challenge them. And even though, for example, in the trio, the Tchaikovsky trio is a wonderful melodious piece, as people hear, and it's a very special piece, and we'll talk a little bit about it at the concert. We always mention some things about the pieces. It's a challenge for the audience because it is a 50-minute work. In other words, the audience has to sit and concentrate on a very powerful piece, and Tchaikovsky was known for that. And when he wrote for a piano trio, he was writing a symphony for three people, and that's what this piece is in many respects. And the same thing with the piano piece that when I talked to John, I said, well, has anybody played Pictures on Exhibition for a while? And he said, no. So I said, well, this would be a great piece to play because, again, it's very colorful. It's very imaginative. It's programmatic. There's, again, you're dealing with musical descriptions of pictures that Mussorgsky saw when he went to the exhibit of a memorial exhibit of Victor Hartmann, who just passed the year earlier. And each picture has some connotations to him. And then there's the famous promenade themes, which describes Mussorgsky himself walking through the exhibit and things like that. So it's a very interesting piece in that sense. So they get a little bit of seriousness in Beethoven, and then they get sort of a magical fairy tale type of stuff in Mussorgsky's Pictures from an Exhibition.
Okay, that's awesome. And John, is this wrapping up the winter season of the piano series, these concerts this weekend, or are we looking forward to something down the line here?
Well, next month, March, there will be two concerts, and then June, there will be two more concerts.
Oh, so
for this
it's not
season.
Done at all.
Yeah. Then I think we title it the winter concerts because we sort of have these groups of concerts at a time. But
I see.
Yeah.
And what's the best place? I think you have a Facebook page. Is that the best place to follow the piano series?
Yeah. Yeah, basically. There's just search Juno Piano Series on Facebook, and it should pop right up.
Absolutely. Okay. And once again, give us the rundown for this weekend, performance times, and
where
we get tickets.
So tonight, 7 p.m. at the Jack, you can get tickets online at the Jack box office or call the number you said at the beginning of the hour.
586-2787.
Yes.
Or ARTS, as it used to be called, but nobody remembers how to do the letters to the
letters
numbers
to
anymore.
Letters to numbers. Yeah. There's that tonight. And then Sunday, February 23rd at 3 p.m. General admission, $25. Senior, $20. Student youth, $10. And extra $5 at the door. So get your tickets sooner.
In advance is the best. Edward Zilberkant and John Hayes from the Juno Piano Series, thank you so much, Gwyneth Cheese, for being here. Really a pleasure talking with you both.
Same.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
We're going to go out as we go to break. We're going to take a listen to a little bit of more of Edward playing. This is from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, and this is the Marketplace. So thank you so much for being
thank
here,
you.
Gwyneth Cheese. Thank you. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Support from Hanson Gress, seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Besikuli. And the word this week is Janwu.
Janwu.
That means mountain goat. And here is a sentence. When boating on the Taku River, people always see mountain goats on the mountains. Let's hear it again. Mountain goat. Gunnish Cheesh to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gulbalt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Besikuli is Koketan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. 2025 marks the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Northwest ADA Center helps to provide information, training, and research, and covers Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. You can find out more at nwadacenter.org. That's northwestadacenter.org, nwadacenter.org. And I'm pleased to welcome John Doris, Assistant Director at the Northwest ADA Center, to the program. Gunnith Cheesh, Ha'igudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with you today. John, Wasa'iti, how's it going?
I'm great. Thank you for having me again, Boston.
Of
course. It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. So let's remind people about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it's 35 years. That's amazing.
Where's the time gone, right? It's flown by. The ADA is a civil rights law, and it's one of several civil rights protections to protect people with disabilities. The ADA was passed in 1990, and it was the world's first civil rights law to protect people with disabilities. So it has different sections, and it's a collection of laws that address different aspects of life, whether it's employment or in local government programs, services, the public accommodations when you're out and about, like if you go to a coffee shop or if you go to a sports game or anything like that. There's different laws and regulations that impact what should be put in place and how businesses should interact with customers to make sure that they have full program access and people are able to access those programs and services.
Absolutely. That's really awesome. And I'm sure there's been studies that the ADA, you know, and the Northwest ADA Center have done in terms of seeing those improvements. Has it been a marked improvement since 1990?
Well, I would say yes. There's a lot of different research, and it's sometimes hard to quantify because a lot of times people will have invisible disabilities and they may not self-report a disability. And it's sometimes not, the data is not there to measure whether small changes at the local level have really impacted, but there's definitely an improvement, and you can just see it when you go to, whether you go to a building where that has new codes, that has better access and has improvements with recognizing people communicate differently and installing technology so that people that use assistive listening devices are able to access those services without having to ask for them because they're already in place. So there's the ADA has sparked a lot of improvement, and a lot of businesses, corporations have made that push to say, we really should look at the environment and how have we created this system and what can we do just to improve for people with disabilities. But the side effect is it's improving everybody, because a lot of times people don't realize the obstacles that exist because we've already addressed them and we've made improvements so that we don't have to worry about that. The simple example is the doorknob. By instead of replacing a round ball with a lever, it makes it much easier for people that might have an impairment with their hand or may not be able to use the same kind of pressure. So every day it's easier for people to access a building, for example, just by making one slight change.
Obviously, for those without a disability, like I can see certain things, like I can see the wheelchair access, or I can see, you know, the elevator access, or like you said, the handle on the door. But you bring up the invisible disabilities, and in terms of how are those areas being improved? How can we learn more about what we could do, or what other options are available for folks who might have the invisible disability?
Well, great question. I think the first thing is just by increasing awareness and having all of us, whether it's a local government or whether it's an employer, be aware that disabilities are often not obvious. And so when somebody approaches you and says they have this disability, for example, let's say it's in a workplace and somebody has diabetes and they would need a workplace accommodation to say, well, I have a disability. Here's if they need to provide medical documentation, it's there, and they can arrange a workplace accommodation. And the employer wouldn't have such a hard time implementing that when they've already increased their awareness to say, yes, all kinds of disabilities exist that aren't obvious. And then providing notice to say, we are aware of this disability, and putting that out there for customers and for the citizenry. So when you go to City Hall, there's a nice sign that says, we are aware of disabilities. If you need any assistance, please come and ask and request the appropriate assistive device that you might need. So increasing awareness and then publicizing, making those notice requirements to let people know that, oh, look, they are aware. It's not going to be awkward for me to go and ask for that. And then just by implementing some changes like auditory listening systems, like a hearing loop, by installing that in your facility, just makes it easier for people to have the effective communication, and they never have to ask because it's already in place.
Mm. What do you mean? You said hearing loop. What does that mean?
Well, there's different technology where you can install in an office space or in an assembly area. And people that use assistive listening devices like a hearing aid, there's could be like a little telecoil inside the device, and it can pair with the system that's installed in a facility so that they're able to hear, and it increases it augments what they can hear, but also increases the clarity of what's being said. So like a simple example, if you're going to a city council meeting, you have a pretty standard area. So you can install that technology. There's wires, for example, that would go under the floor, and it would extend the range of that technology where people can listen. So they can sit anywhere in that room generally, depending on the technology, and hear and have improved clarity just from that hearing aid because of the telecoil that's inside the system.
Wow, that's amazing.
Right? Yeah. It's something that it may be a little bit expensive to add to a building that doesn't have it. But if you're already making those improvements, if you're addressing some changes within a structure, or if you're making a brand new structure, then it was, you know, those costs would be built into the beginning of the beginning of the structure. So it wouldn't be cost prohibitive.
Yeah, it's amazing, I guess, the technology and how it furthers and gets more and more as technology improves, or gets even more complicated in terms of how how it can help so much in ways that we can't even possibly imagine right now in terms of that. And people are thinking of ways to do that. Like, I wouldn't even have thought of some kind of technology that you could install to improve the range of the hearing loop. That doesn't even come as an idea for me, but just what a cool thing that technology allows that to be something that can be done. Yeah.
Right. It is amazing how things have changed, but when sometimes it's just not, you know, it's not installed, or it may be prohibitive. It doesn't necessarily, it's not, doesn't prevent like a Title II agency, like a local government. They could, you know, there's other ways they could, you know, provide written documentation about, you know, ahead of time, so that the person, if there isn't that system already installed, then they could, somebody could have it with them or some other kind of visual aid to help. So there's multiple ways to think about it. And there's definitely technology is going to help, and it will help people. But, you know, sometimes the tried and true older methods are still helpful, especially with different budgets in different areas.
Absolutely. Print it out, right? Like, have something you can print out on paper. No problem with that. And that's kind of what the Northwest ADA Center is all about, right, is getting people the education and the training to learn the different ways that things might be possible within a budget and all the different technologies that may exist. Tell me a little bit about the Northwest ADA Center in terms of its main sort of goal and mission.
We want to help people understand the ADA and their rights and obligations. And we do answer a lot of questions from all kinds of people to sort of problem solve or understand what may be happening. We do get calls from local governments that say, oh, well, for example, we're going to have a temporary event outside. It's going to be like a fair. So what should we do to make sure that we've addressed accessibility so we can walk through what are the issues that have happened in a temporary event? What are you going to do about parking? And if parking's an issue, maybe you can have a shuttle, make sure there's a paratransit shuttle. So just walking through all the aspects of an event. And the same thing with businesses. Sometimes businesses will be concerned, well, the ADA sounds so expensive. I don't want to get sued. What should I do? So it's just listening and understanding, because so much of it is very context specific. So what might be appropriate for one business, let's say it's a coffee shop that's in a strip mall versus a restaurant that's using a renovated, you know, 1800 building that doesn't have the same kind of accessibility features. So those two are very different concerns, because there's going to be different budgetary issues about how would you address accessibility and what's technically feasible. So it's walking them through and giving them some assurance about, well, this is what the ADA says, and these are things that, if you know, if you're going to make these choices, be conscious of these other factors. And then if something is just technically infeasible, then maybe think about other ways to provide your service. And the most common, and we learned that from COVID, is that, well, maybe we can just go curbside service. You don't have to go inside a building and mingle. If somebody isn't able to go into a building, then let's give them curbside service, or maybe do a delivery service. And it's just ways to think about making sure people have access. Because the ADA originally, and a lot of protections, is we recognize that people with disabilities have a harder time sometimes getting out. We don't want them to be isolated. We don't want to segregate them. So the most, you know, opportunity to participate is important. And if we sort of think about that as a primary consideration, then we can sort of problem solve and brainstorm how do we address an issue and reach a happy or satisfactory conclusion.
I'm talking with John Doris from the Northwest ADA Center. And not everything is about physical accessibility, John, too, because the world is so digital these days. Can we talk a little bit about things that the Northwest ADA Center can help out with in terms of digital accessibility?
Sure. There is last year there was a new regulation that was encouraging and creates deadlines for Title II entities like state, local governments to ensure that their websites are digitally accessible. So there's a standard, the WCAG 2.1 standard. So there's a clear guideline. If you're in the city of Juneau or Seattle, if you have stuff on the internet and it's important for people to access your services or programs, for example, if I need to ask for an accommodation, or if I'm doing something to reserve time at the library, whatever it is, however I'm accessing, they need to make sure that it's compatible with those accessibility standards. So we've done presentations for Title II entities to let them understand what do those guidelines mean, and then what are the issues that are going to be tripping points. So what are things that you need to be mindful of? Now, that particular rule doesn't apply to businesses, but we also help Title III entities, which are the businesses, and help them understand they still have obligations too for digital accessibility. There's some case law that says all of this is part of effective communication, which is a requirement under the ADA. You need to be able to effectively communicate with somebody that has different disabilities. So there's companies, there are consulting companies that will help people create accessible websites. So we give them the information about what the requirements are and things to be mindful of. And people have reached out asking for references or asking to see if we can point people in the right direction or some pitfalls to avoid that may not be helpful.
What are some of the simple things that, let's say, a small business or I understand, like with the Title II, the city and state governments, things like that, that they have a little bit more requirements on them. But let's say a small business owner wants to make their website a little more accessible. What are some of the steps they could take to do that?
Well, they could read up on the standards, the WCAG 2.1 standards. It's a little bit older. There's 2.2 is out. Or has been out. Some simple things are like looking at the contrast to make sure that the text is sufficient. The contrast is sufficient so that people who have vision impairments may be able to read it properly. Or there's some websites that let you test your website. People can email us or call for that information. I don't have it offhand what that exact website is, but there's one that will like look at your website for you and point out some problems that exist. And then you can hire people who have disabilities and say, try to access our website and tell us where are you getting tripped out? Where are the problems with this website that we need to address and fix? And unemployment rates are a little bit higher for people who are disabled, and they would welcome that employment opportunity to be testers for businesses to say, oh, well, if I'm utilizing a screen reader, is this website compatible with the screen reader? And a lot of times they're not. So that would be good to know and have somebody, a real world person, test those. So there's technology to test and then real world testing.
Absolutely. So if people needed more information or wanted to reach out, what's the best way to contact the Northwest ADA Center?
We do have a phone. The national hotline is routed to us, the 800-949-4232. Oftentimes an email is best because we end up needing to email them back the information. So nwadactr@uw.edu.
At uw.edu, nwadactr at uw.edu.
Yes, sir.
That's a lot of letters.
That is a lot of letters.
There's a lot of letters. Nice long letters there making that acronym. Yeah, that's great. So the 800 number, 800-949-4232, or nwadactr at uw.edu for the Northwest ADA Center. John, thanks so much. Congratulations on 35 years. We look forward to many more, and I know that you're all doing good work. You were in Alaska last year doing some talking with people around the state. You all come up on occasion because you have a wide Northwest distribution. You're all over Alaska, Idaho, Washington, Oregon. So thank you for taking the time today and giving us a little information on the center itself.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course, I appreciate it. Gunath Cheesh. Okay, up next, we get our cool jazz on and talk to the group continuing their residency every Friday at the Crystal Saloon. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
And when you're done, make it do it all again.
Yeah, you are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Felicia Daje is a six-member group. It is Heather, Luke, Clay, Sam, Mike, and David. And you can find them every Friday night at the Crystal Saloon at 6 p.m. And I am welcoming Heather and Luke into the studio now. Gunath Chi, Sha'i Gudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio today. Wasiti, how's it going?
Wasiti. Hi, Boston.
Oh, I got to turn you on. That's good. That's a good thing to do. I was so into your music there that...
We were jamming in here.
Talking about that song, Tones and I, an Australian busker who got famous and apparently is the first female to have 2 billion listens online and unbelievable. But you took that song and kind of jazzed it up a little bit. So I'm just curious, like, when you were thinking about a song... like taking a pop song like that, but then putting it into sort of through the jazz filter. How do you decide to do that? Or are there certain songs that are like more, you know, better to do that with?
Well, I would say, you know, I mean, what I do, I manage the band and I kind of bring these songs to the group as a selection to explore. And... I kind of just let these professional musicians just do what they want, and it evolves into really cool jams like these. Like, we've got different styles in that tune. Like, I mean, we've got jazz, kind of a salsa-ish vibe, too, and that's something that just evolves during that piece. Like, that piece, you know, it wasn't played like that ever again. We kind of play it really differently each time. It's really... to the core jazz.
Because jazz allows for that sort of exploration, right, Luke? It sort of allows to kind of show, you know, you're playing along and then you point to the other person and be like, okay, you take it. And they just kind of riff on and then you're all riffing together. Is that how it kind of works?
That's right, Boston. You never do know what you're going to get. But, you know, we do promise that you'll enjoy it. So,
yes. Right.
Cool jazz.
Cool jazz.
That's what we're featuring.
So how does it, you know, it's interesting because do you have to feel, and this is 6 members, I think, right? 6 people.
Yeah, so tonight we have a 6-person show. We are essentially a jazz quintet. So we've got piano, upright bass, drums, trombone, and voice as a standard. Tonight we're adding a little bit of miscellaneous percussion by David Shakely.
Oh, okay. That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
So normally it's a 5-member every Friday?
Yeah, we're...
But you bring in guests all the time,
yes,
probably.
Yes, yeah.
And how... Let's get the details out of the way before we get more questions in there. So you're at the Crystal Saloon every Friday at 6 o'clock.
Yes.
And is it going through a certain period at this point? When are you going till?
We are going until March 21st.
March 21st. So about another month.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you got a few more chances to do that. And this is the second time you've sort of been in residence at the Crystal Saloon.
Right. We did one residency about this time last year. It seems to fall within the legislative season a little bit, which is cool because we'll get that crowd hanging out. The Crystal Saloon has pizza now, and they're expanding their dinner options probably as we speak. So it's a really cool place to hang out on a Friday night that where you can have dinner and music, and it's low-key. You could dance if you want to. It's just a great situation that they have going down there. So we're really pleased to have this residency at the Crystal Saloon.
Yeah, you can also bring your kids.
Yeah.
Is something at the Crystal Saloon before 8 o'clock, as long as they are accompanied by a guardian.
Nice. Yeah. So you can grab some pizza or food or whatever options they might be getting and listen to a little jazz.
Yeah, so kind of a unique scenario in downtown Juneau. We should definitely be taking advantage of this, you know, moment of dinner and a show with kids welcome. And it's just a good vibe.
I love that. It's a great way to celebrate a Friday for sure. So how did you all get this group going? How did it start?
Well, it started with Luke and I at kind of doing it as a duo format. And that was, almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years ago this summer that we started like something under the name Afal Sidaji. And so it was a duo between Luke and I. And we would play sometimes at the Crystal or private shows. And then last year around this time or around January, we decided to ask Clay Good and Sam Roberts to join along and start jamming out. And it just kind of keeps unfolding. And now we've got Mike Busey and then a guest of David Shakely. So It's just jazzy. It just kind of keeps
it feels kind of like jazz, right? It's just sort of organic a little bit. Like it has sort of grown over time.
Yeah, it is organic. And one of the things we attempt to do, too, is to partner with different, you know, people or organizations in town. So, for instance, last year and also this year, we're going to be partnering with the jazz radio host at KRNN, Robert Sewell.
Oh, nice.
So I believe that's going to be happening on what date?
That's this upcoming first Friday, March 7th.
Okay, so on Friday, March 7th, he will be presenting and, you know, giving his own unique take on some of these songs.
Oh, cool.
He'll be provided a set list so he can, you know,
guide us through the
wanderings of the jazz repertoire, maybe provide a little backstory to some of this material. So that's going to be happening.
I'm sure it will be amusing and educational.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting because, you know, I know he has the show that he does, and you're all doing this every Friday. And does it feel like, where are we at with jazz in Juneau? Jazz in Juneau. I know we have Juneau Jazz and Classics. Right? They do their thing every year. But, like, where's the what about the rest of the year?
Yeah, I think Juneau is an interesting town for many kinds of music. I've lived in several places, including large urban areas in the lower 48 states. And, you know, I must say, like, there are, you know, a wider variety of musical opportunities here in Juneau, and maybe also musical genres being, you know, played regularly at a variety of venues than any place I've lived. Well, that doesn't include New York City or Los Angeles, but there's quite a wide variety of music here in Juneau. It's not just folk music, and I think there's a increasingly a vibrant jazz scene too, and the town is attracting some musicians who are from other places and who are maybe playing at that caliber that you would find in larger cities like New York City or Los Angeles. And the reason that they stay here is that the musical opportunities are so rich and varied. And I would say Sam Roberts, our bass player, is one of those musicians. I might consider myself one as well. I think it's a thriving little jazz scene. And maybe I'll give a plug here for the jazz jam that happens every week at the Crystal Saloon on Tuesday nights. That's hosted by me and Rob Cohen on alternate weeks. Rob Cohen is another jazz piano player here in town. And that's an open jam where players can come in and try their hand at this style of music. And that's been going for several years. And we hope it continues to keep going because it's a good way for people to cut their teeth, and so to speak. And
just meet other players. That are interested in exploring these standards or more. Like, for example, this past Tuesday, there were upwards of 10 people on stage at one time, and everybody with a chance to solo, and it was very diverse. And, you know, we had some people playing the drums that are really great at it, and then there was also me just kind of exploring the cymbal. But it's a really good time. So I would say, I would say I see a golden jazz community here in Juneau right now.
Well, it's cool about the musicians that are in this town, like you're talking about, Luke, is that it seems like, and I know jazz is sort of a great format for this, where people can collaborate, but it also seems like maybe people who are in other forms are also then collaborating with people who are in some other form, some other genre, and they're all mixing together. And it's part of the beauty of Juneau, really, right? That we're small enough that everybody kind of knows what's going on. It's like, well, hey, you're doing this. You're on the keys, Luke. Let's get together, and I want to do this. Let's try our hand at this particular song and just see what happens.
Yeah, I call it band camp for adults. It's like a 365 day a year band camp.
Yeah.
And you know, if you ever went to band camp as a a child or a young adult, you'll probably know what I'm talking about. But Juno is a lot like that, and it's, you know, and it goes year-round, not just during the tourist season.
Yeah.
And that makes it kind of a uniquely fun place to play and to form, you know, different ensembles and, you know, to play with people who are conversant in different styles. You know, Heather and I have other projects. This is not our only project. And, you know, and so we meet a lot of different musicians and play in a lot of different styles. I do think that this Ophelis Adagi project is quite special because it is, in my opinion, a jazz ensemble that is kind of uniquely professional in its presentation and sound, and also in the level of the players. I believe it's comparable to what you would find in any major city in the lower 48. And so I think it's worth checking out if people haven't, because we do take the jazz style quite seriously. It's not just, you know, show tunes with a singer, although that is wonderful too. You know, there's a lot of improvisation and, a diversity of interpretation that happens. You never do know what is going to happen with this ensemble. And I think that makes it fun. And I also think it makes it a rewarding ensemble to come back and listen to time and again. You know, it's not the same show every week. You'll hear, you know, things that are quite different every time you listen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the Ophelis Adagi, which is at the Crystal Saloon every Friday from now until March 21st. Starts at 6 o'clock. Where can we get more information, Heather, quickly?
Can get more information. I'm posting on my Instagram page. That's Castle of Feather. Or you can find information on the Crystal Saloon website.
Yeah, crystalsaloon.com. Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Thanks so much, Gunth Cheese, for being here.
Thank you so much, Boston.
Okay, that will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp, Gunnith Cheesh, and have a wonderful Juno-filled weekend.